10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. This coming weekend is the opening weekend of a series of performances at Carthage College of a new verbatim play called Fighting for Home, Stories of Women Who Serve. And this is yet another very meaningful project under the direction of Martin McClendon from Carthage's theater faculty. Martin McClendon cares deeply about veterans and their experience and cares deeply about seeing that their stories are more widely shared. And one of the things that Martin McClendon and the entire theater faculty is exceptionally excited about is the fact that there will be a special guest who will be on the campus of Carthage for the performance of Fighting for Home on Saturday the 22nd. Her name is Eileen Rivers. She is a veteran and a journalist for more than 15 years with both the Washington Post and USA Today. She is with USA Today now, and she has written extensively and effectively about the experience of veterans. And one of her most important bits of work has been to tell the story of women in combat, and very powerfully so in a book published by Da Capo Press called Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. It is a fascinating, riveting book, which takes us right into the heart of the experience of women on the front lines in this difficult, ongoing war in Afghanistan. And as I said, Eileen Rivers is going to be on the campus of Carthage to talk about this book, to sign copies of this book, and to expand on what she has learned in speaking with many soldiers, many of them women, who are on the front lines in some of these complex war situations. And I'm very honored to be able to speak with Eileen Rivers for the next few minutes about her book and about her many experiences. Eileen Rivers, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this. And thank you for that kind introduction. That was wonderful.
So just briefly, tell us something about what compelled you to be yourself part of the military.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I come from a military family. I was actually talking to somebody about this just yesterday. It's so rare now to find families where everyone has served, but I'm the youngest of four children. My father was in the Army. He served in Vietnam. My oldest brother went into the Army in the 1970s, late 70s, early 80s. I have another brother who was Navy. And my older sister also went to the Navy. And so while I went to college straight out of high school, I don't know, there was sort of this expectation to join the military. I grew up near a military base. I had a lot of friends who were also military and who actually became linguists in the military. And I always loved languages. And, you know, there was an opportunity to be an Arabic linguist in the military. And I thought, wow, the military is going to pay me to learn Arabic, challenging language, great opportunity. And so I thought I'd try it. I thought I'd take it. And I'm glad that I did. I learned so much, and it expanded my world perspective.
I just wonder if you could also say a quick word about once you stepped into the world of journalism and were mm-hmm. covering military matters and matters related to veterans, what were both the advantages and the disadvantages of you yourself being a veteran?
So it definitely gave me the ability to look at the coverage that not just the Washington Post and USA Today were doing, but mainstream media coverage overall of the military, of the experiences of women, and of the experiences of people at war in general. So I definitely saw, I think, the coverage in a way that a lot of my counterparts in journalism didn't, because they hadn't had that experience. And there was a lot, in my view, to be critical of. And again, I'm not just talking about the papers that I worked at, but just a lot of what I was seeing in mainstream media. So it seemed to me that the only thing that I was seeing about the military were a lot of the negative stories about women being victimized. And I certainly don't want to diminish what happens to women who are victimized. It's a very serious problem, and it's a very serious issue that the military still needs to find a way to deal with that is fair and equitable to women. And I definitely support women who have had problems, and I'm all for the military figuring out, it's long past time for them to figure out how to deal with issues. But I also knew that my experience as a woman was incredibly positive, and I hadn't seen a lot of that kind of coverage. We were also at a point where we were seeing a lot of coverage about people, you know, giving up documents to Wikipedia, and people in the field, you know, killing civilians, treating people of Muslim faith horribly in Afghanistan, going through villages and, you know, wiping out families. And these were things that definitely needed to be covered, but I felt like there was a lot missing about soldiers who get up every day and work incredibly hard, about women who were out there on the front line, fighting side by side with their male counterparts, going the extra mile, doing things that technically women weren't even supposed to be doing or weren't getting credit for doing. I had an inkling that stuff was going on even before I started the book. And so there was a lot that seemed to me to be missing in the coverage. And that's what inspired me to start a project that I started for USA Today, where I thought, you know, everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody's kind of a documentarian. I want to see the stories of war from people on the ground who are actually out there. And so I put out a call to action, and I said, send me your photos, send me your videos. I want to collect your stories. I want to tell a different story of war. I think you're right. It was because I had that military background that I realized there's a gap in coverage here, and I want to try to fill it.
So explain to our listeners what was missing for all of the torrent of photos that almost immediately began coming in from troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was something missing, at least at first, as far as you were concerned.
Well, I wasn't getting those photos from women, at first.
Right. In other words, these are all photos showing men in action and no women to be seen.
That's right. And I knew that there were women out there. I thought, man, I hope I do get a photo of a woman at some point. Excuse me. And then I finally did. There was a part of me that was sort of surprised and a part of me that wasn't. Even I had, as I was collecting all these photos, even though I knew women were out there and women were making a difference, there were a lot of details about what women were actually going through on the front lines that I didn't know. And so I was so excited when I saw that, the picture of Liz Carlin. I mentioned her in the book as somebody who kind of inspired me to begin digging deeper and finding out more stories of women on the front lines and ultimately writing this book. When her photo came across my computer screen, I immediately jumped into action, reached out to her, and said, tell me about the experiences of women on the front lines. And she mentioned something called female engagement teams. And I thought, wow, I'm a woman who has served, and I don't even know what that is. So I know if I don't know what that is, man, nobody's heard about this. Nobody's really writing a lot about this. And so I immediately wanted to find more stories, get more information, try to find women who could tell their stories well, about what they were experiencing on the front lines, and that was the genesis of the book.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eileen Rivers, who works for USA Today, but we're talking today about a book of hers, which actually sprang from a USA Today project. The book is titled Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. It chronicles in depth the experience of three different American women in the military, and also tells the story of an Afghan woman who, in a sense, was a beneficiary of the work of these female engagement teams, although she is also herself a very powerful force for good in her native land. I want to ask you about a couple of things about the book, aside from the stories told of these three American women in the military. Your book begins with what I think is a very interesting sketch of the history of women in the military, beginning with a woman by the name of Deborah Sampson, the first woman, American woman, known to have fought in battle back in Revolutionary War days, and then kind of sketching from there what is actually a very slow progress in terms of women being allowed to be part of military action at all. I found it to be a surprisingly complicated and extensive history, and I think most people reading this opening section of your book will be probably similarly surprised. And I wonder if even you were surprised as you did some research into this.
I was, and I'm so glad you mentioned Deborah Sampson, and I'm glad you phrased the statement about her the way you did. You said that she was the first woman known to have served, and that's absolutely the right way to say it, because there were women who were not outed until their bodies were found dead on the battlefield. There were women who were disguising themselves as men, and that's what Deborah Sampson did. People who don't know her story, she was a woman who wanted to serve. Of course, women weren't allowed to serve during the Revolutionary War, so she dressed up as a man so that she could serve. And for the longest time, men in her unit didn't know she was a man, including the commander that she became an aide-de-camp for. She was such a good soldier. She was faster than a lot of men. She was a better shot than a lot of men. She grew up around boys, so that in many ways explains that. She grew up hunting and running and doing all those things with other boys. And so it was very natural for her to be around men and be competitive doing these things. And so the fascinating thing about her story and other women like them is, A, their level of dedication, which we still see today in these female engagement team women, and B, how much the men who were around her, when they didn't know she was a woman, were willing to follow her into battle because they thought she was such a great soldier. And so, yeah, it's good that you phrase it, the first woman known to have. Because when a lot of soldiers died in the field, and then they would go get the bodies and examine them, they found out that some of these men were actually women. And so that was a surprising story for me. I hadn't learned about Deborah Sampson in school. I discovered her as I was writing this book. I initially had an entire chapter and wanted to do a couple of chapters on her story and had to kind of scrap those, but I wanted to feature her prominently in that chronology. And I think you're right as well that the progress has been incredibly slow. I mean, the pattern for the military is to kind of use women when it's necessary and convenient for them, but initially not give women the credit. And then as soon as the military doesn't need them for that particular function, kind of throw them back to the lower level function that they had in the first place until they're pushed to the point where they realize, okay, we can't do that anymore, and women are much more vital and necessary to this particular motivation or this particular goal that we have in the military. We can't deny how vital they are anymore to achieve that goal, so we have to push them forward. And there's certainly a pattern of that throughout the history of women in the military, and that was also seen in what happened with the Fed. I mean, they realized that they needed women to frisk other women in these very sensitive areas and countries that were primarily Muslim countries. So the plan was initially just to use them for that. And then they realized, wow, women are serving such a vital function. We can no longer deny that they're in combat, although they've been doing it for years and we didn't want to acknowledge it. And we realized that we need them in order to serve this mission well. And so now we have to push them forward. Mm. So progress, you know, you're right. The pattern of progress is incredibly slow. And these women have persevered continually through it all. And that's part of what made the progress possible.
Right. And there's just something so incredibly inspiring about the notion of so many women through the generations being desperate to serve our country's military in one way or another. And sometimes overcoming tremendous obstacles and resistance for the sake of doing so. I mean, it stirs the soul to think about the women who have felt so compelled to try to be a
Absolutely.
Part of all this.
No, and that's an incredible point. You know, it does say something that women have been so dedicated that even in the face of, you know, a system that's essentially saying, either A, we don't want you here, or B, we want you here, but we want you to serve less than you're able to. The fact that women have been saying since the beginning of this country, no, I want to stand up and be counted, and I will keep coming back to this brick wall until you fully see me, that absolutely says something about the perseverance and spirit of women who want to serve.
Before we talk a little more about the specific work of these FETs or female engagement teams, I want you to expand on an intriguing line in your book when you say both Afghan and American women were fighting multiple wars. I think
Right.
part of what we have just been talking about is at least part of what you're saying about the multiple wars being fought by American women. Tell us if there is even more to that, and then also the way in which Afghan women, to whom these women in the FETs were reaching out, how they were also finding themselves fighting multiple wars.
Yeah, that's a great question. I often say that, you know, one of the reasons I included Jamila, who is the Afghan woman that I, you know, whose story I really tell in this book, is because I also wanted to show how women who are fighting in Afghanistan are also soldiers on the front lines, just in a very different way. And there were certainly parallels between those multiple wars that both women were fighting. The war against sexism and the war for gender equality. That was what both women, sets of women were fighting, you know, on the ground in Afghanistan, one within a military structure, the American female soldiers I write about, and then one, you know, like Jamila on the ground against the Taliban. Both women certainly faced gender discrimination by very powerful men. And so I think could relate to one another in very profound ways because of that. And so that was one huge war that both women got from each other and understood and came together to fight. And then the other war is the war on the ground. We certainly don't think of women in Afghanistan as being powerful or as wanting to control their own destiny. But when so many women were standing up and saying, I want to vote, which is what Jamila was trying to get women to do, in the face of terrifying consequences potentially, that was them stepping forward and saying, I want to have a voice in how my country is run. I am, you know, a foot soldier on the ground and changing this. And Jamila certainly represented that. So there was the war for gender equality that both were fighting, even though in America we love to think that we're so much further ahead than women in other countries. In a lot of ways on the ground in Afghanistan, we saw that that wasn't necessarily the case and that both women were fighting to be seen as capable and fighting to get over their gender defining the limits of what they could do. And then, of course, the fight against the Taliban in a very profound way for both of them represented a way that they could prove themselves as capable women. So, yeah, they were both fighting these sort of multiple wars against themselves, against their gender, and, of course, the war against the Taliban. They sort of all wove in this complicated way.
Hmm. We're speaking with Eileen Rivers about her book, Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. We need to be sure to talk about the three women whose experience you most deeply and deeply chronicle in your book. I'd like you to tell us about these three women and also the way in which these three women, while there certainly is a through line connecting their experiences, represent an array of different experiences in the midst of this new kind of modern warfare in which we find ourselves engaged in Afghanistan.
Right. So I like the way you say different experiences there, because I really tried to pick three different women, A, who could tell their stories really well, but B, whose stories emphasize the different ways in which women were vital to the fight. Female engagement teams, just to backtrack a little bit so people understand the basic premise behind them, were teams of three to four women, and those women attached to combat units who were going out on missions. So if a combat unit was called up to ruck march out to a mission somewhere where they thought, you know, there was Taliban activity or something may have been happening, they would say, okay, we need a SEC team to attach to our unit. We're going to X location, and we're going to need to frisk women. And so those women were exposed to just as much danger. If there was a battle where they had to stop and jump out of their vehicle and start fighting, women did that. And so all of those activities in terms of attaching to combat units and going out, and then also in terms of the female engagement team specific missions where they would hold shuras, which are meetings, to promote voting rights for women. They would hold shuras to bring medical aid to women. They would hold shuras to talk about medical needs of children, to bring food and supplies. All of women did that. But one thing I tried to do was, when I interviewed these women, allow them to kind of take the lead on what was the most important part of the mission for them. And so Maria Rodriguez, for example, was a high-ranking military officer in the Army. She wore multiple hats. In addition to doing these SEC missions, she also was a provost marshal, which meant for all of these units in Afghanistan, she was in charge of military police. She was in charge of how detainees were treated, how they were captured, to a certain extent, how they were interrogated. On top of all of that, she did another SEC mission, which was trying to train Afghan female police officers to take over when female engagement teams left the country. And that's the part that moved her the most, and that she really felt was a profound experience for her in Afghanistan. We had Joanna Smoke in the book, but she's since remarried, so now she's Joanna Hip, who really fell in love with Jamila, which is the woman I feature in the book, and really admired her bravery so much in terms of going out trying to get Afghan women to vote. And so I wanted to focus on that part of the story for her. Sheena Adams represented so much in this book. She was in the Marines, and she really, to me, represented the Kevlar feeling. I know we haven't mentioned that yet, but, you know, just talking about her story, I want to throw that out there. The Kevlar ceiling is kind of the military enlisted equivalent of what we call the glass ceiling in the civilian world, where women get promoted but only go so far. She was really gung-ho about being in combat, being a combat Marine. She fought and fought and fought to be on a female engagement team, really rose to leadership on female engagement teams. And then when she got back, she was slowly exited out of the military. She could not be promoted after she got back from Afghanistan because, A, she couldn't be judged on doing her job. This was the catch-22 that so many women found themselves in when they went into combat. When you go into combat as a female, this is before combat rules opened, you were no longer really doing your job. You were completing a set mission because other combat units need you to do that, which means that when you got back, you couldn't be evaluated for promotion on doing your job because you weren't doing it. And you couldn't be evaluated really on what you did in the field because you were away from your primary unit. So you go out there, you put your life on the line, you do all this work, you come back, you can't be fairly evaluated. In addition to that, she went on maternity leave, and so she wasn't there for the promotion board. She didn't get promoted. You can only stay in the military for so long at one particular rank before you either have to get promoted or leave. And because of all these obstacles in her way after combat, she couldn't get promoted, and so she had to cycle out of the military, which was really unfortunate for her. She loved to serve. She loved the military. And she just got caught in this unfortunate circumstance that so many women found themselves in after serving in combat. So I really wanted to emphasize three different kinds of stories with these women, and I hope I did that well.
I think you did very, very well. One of the realities of the war in Afghanistan is that this is a new kind of war, and that it is also a war in which I think you say at one point, the front lines are everywhere. So it is not like the kind of standard battles we think of in the wars of past generations. But and so even when, for instance, a member of one of these female engagement teams is going out into a neighborhood, at a glance it might not seem like they are on the front lines of a war. But wherever you go in a place like this, you are submitting to enormous peril, facing incredible dangers and threats on every hand, everywhere you go.
Absolutely. I mean, it's guerrilla warfare. So at any moment, members of the Taliban could pop up on top of buildings, you know, from behind what looked like very innocent shops in the middle of a bazaar and start firing. And quite frequently, that's what happened. Sheena Adams went out on rotation once, and she said, we were in this neighborhood, and things were just a little too quiet. And if something is too quiet, and you don't see people in a bazaar doing what you would expect, engaging in commerce, milling around, going to different shops, if you're not seeing that and it's too quiet, there's something wrong. And on that particular mission, she also tried to engage with women. So she saw a couple of women walking through the bazaar and tried to talk to them, and they just quickly moved ahead and barely made eye contact. And all of the people on this mission started looking around, and then, you know, the mission leader said, you know what, let's head out, because something here is not right. And when they were heading out and going back to the FOB, that's when they were attacked. So they realized there was something wrong. They were attacked. They jumped out of the, there was an IED that blasted through the vehicle. Sheena Adams actually suffered from traumatic brain injury because of that. They all jumped out of their vehicles and started firing back. So, yeah, women in a very big way were right there in the thick of it, and you never quite knew where the thick of it would be. Mm. You always had to be prepared to respond.
Right. A last quick comment from you. At one point, I believe it is Major General Michael Flynn who is quoted in talking about the important work of these female engagement teams, says that it is so important to the cause of working with the people that we need to both protect and persuade. And I think that is such an interesting turn of phrase, because in a sense that really underscores the extraordinarily important work done by actually all of our military in these areas, but in particular, it seems to me the work of these female engagement teams really strikes at the heart of what General Flynn was saying there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, part of what female engagement teams did when they first went was that they collected intelligence, and this was a very new, very different way of doing that. One thing I talk about is, I used to be in military intelligence, so I was in Arabic language, and I was what was called a listener. So I would put my headset on, and I would be listening to targets, you know, eavesdropping on phone conversations. But these targets were miles and miles away from me. I mean, often I didn't know exactly where they were. I knew the general area because obviously we were picking up the frequency, but I didn't know exactly where they were. I never saw them face to face. I never really engaged with them. And traditionally, that's the way intelligence has been collected for decades. So in walk these female engagement teams, and they have a completely different way of doing it, right? Not only are they collecting, any kind of SIM card and a cell phone or whatever that might be on the female person that's been hidden there, but they're also engaging with women to talk to them about what their day is like, to talk to them about what they're seeing in their community. They're not interrogating them, which was the male approach when people were talked to face-to-face. They're sitting down and developing relationships. They're going into these women's homes when the men aren't at home, because the women generally stay at home, take care of the kids, take care of the home front. The men are going off to work. But that also means the women are home all day watching their neighborhood. They see the Taliban come in. They see who the Taliban's talking to. They see the Taliban leave. That's also vital information. So female engagement teams were like, well, why don't we just go in and be friends? Why don't we go in and develop relationships and get information that way and find out what their needs are? And so what was recognized by the intelligence community was we're getting a lot more information that way. It's more actionable information. And at the same time, more relationship building, which means that we are changing the image of the American military in these communities. We're making an image that is more inviting and helpful versus combative. So there was a huge sea change in terms of how intelligence could be collected, how much of it could be collected, and how actionable that intelligence could be. And so that's a lot of what was talked about in the report that you mentioned. It was a completely different way of doing things that proved very beneficial.
Wow. Well, your book is jam-packed with fascinating, riveting stories, and I encourage anybody to seek it out. It's again titled Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. It's published by Da Capo Press. And we want to remind everyone that Eileen Rivers is coming to the campus of Carthage on Saturday, February 22nd, to be part of that performance of Fighting for Home, Stories of Women Who Serve, which is a verbatim theater production at Carthage with performances this weekend and the following weekend. Eileen Rivers, it's been a true honor to speak with you about your life and about your fascinating book. Thank you so much. We look forward to having you at Carthage.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much for having me. And then can I also just throw in, I'll be signing and selling books as well.
Very
so
good.
If anybody wants to come by and pick up a copy, I'd love to sign it for you, and I look forward to seeing everyone.
Very good. The time is 8:43. You're listening to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now for a real treasure from the morning show archives from back in 2007. It is not every day that I have the pleasure and honor of having on the other end of the line a Pulitzer Prize winning author. And in this case, it is the author of a little book called The Color Purple. Perhaps you've heard of it. I just can't say how excited I am to be speaking today with writer Alice Walker, with so much beautiful work to her credit, and most recently, a book which we are going to be talking about, intended for children, but a book really that just about everybody needs to take in hand, a book called Why War is Never a Good Idea. It's published by HarperCollins, an absolutely beautifully written and illustrated book. And we will be talking with Alice Walker for the next few minutes about this book. And Alice Walker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, first of all, I think there are a whole lot of people, including people that really have never even been authors before, who nonetheless undertake the task of writing a book for children, because it just seems like a relatively simple thing to do, and maybe don't even realize just how challenging it is, that it's not nearly as simple a matter as it might seem to be on the surface. I wonder for you, because I don't know this about your great career, how much writing for children you specifically have done, and what that experience was like whenever it was that you first undertook the challenge.
Well, this is my fifth book for children, and so I've been thinking about them, you know, all along. And I like to think that I'm writing also to the child and everyone, and especially to the child and myself, because she is still a child, and she still sees the world with a lot of the wonder that I came into this existence with. So I have a great faith that children can grasp and interact with and be enlivened by what I write for that child, the child that is, you know, a child, and the child that's in the adult.
How does it compare for you as a writer? I guess maybe I'm thinking more on the technical end. Is it a simpler matter for you to write an essay or a novel like The Color Purple for people essentially your own age, I mean, for your fellow adults, or do you very comfortably fit into this different role of writing for children as your intended audience?
Well, I have to say it's sort of a surprise to me, because, you know, I didn't really think that much about writing for children. It's just that as time has gone on, I have wanted to communicate certain things that I feel, you know, I could share with them as someone who is much older. I've taken my place as an elder on the planet, and I know and feel my responsibility to be to the young, and to share what I know here, you know, I've learned here. For instance, that we're all connected, that it's all about interbeing. In fact, the book that I did with Stefano Vitale before this one is called There Is a Flower at the Tip of My Nose Smelling Me. And that was written after walking through the forest on an old logging trail with my dog one morning, and just being overwhelmed with the fact that I belong to this universe. I mean, it's just the most amazing thing when you realize the magic that is, that we belong to this enormous, impossibly huge, magical thing that we don't really understand, even though we study it.
And of course, that leads us beautifully into this latest book, and again a collaboration with Stefano Vitale, a book called Why War Is Never a Good Idea. You have written about that in a very interesting way. I mean, there are a lot of very obvious ways that one might put that message across, but you have done so by talking about things that wouldn't seem to immediately have anything to do with war, which is, of course, part of the point. Tell us where you got the idea for talking about this important topic in this way.
Well, I was researching Afghanistan because the government, our government, was planning to bomb it after 9/11, and I wanted to know who was there and the condition of the you know, the people and the land. And I discovered that there were already 700,000, which was the population of San Francisco a few years ago, disabled orphans. And so I was thinking about the ones who couldn't see, the ones who couldn't walk, the ones who couldn't crawl, the ones who didn't have anybody to look after them. And I just knew that I needed to make some small contribution to the understanding among children that when they grow up and they harm other countries, their children, they're just like themselves. And to see war as the enemy, not the people, but to see war itself as the enemy, because it assaults the earth, and the earth is our common earth home.
I've heard it said, and believe this so much to be true, that so much about the quality of a book has to do with the way it begins and its very first words. And the very first words of your book are so wonderful. Before we share them with the audience, I wonder, were they the first thing that came to you as you wrote this book?
Yes.
And may I read them, or do you want to read them?
Would you read them? I think that would be wonderful to hear you read
the,
them.
The opening page of this book says this. Though war speaks every language, it never knows what to say to frogs. I'm intrigued that the book starts this way. I mean, I love that opening. It's interesting when you talk about how, in a sense, the genesis of this book was thinking about the people and the creatures of Afghanistan, a country not particularly known for its frogs. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's where this particular story begins.
Mm-hmm. And so, I bet they have some frogs.
Oh, I'm sure someplace. But, I mean, it's not, of course, immediately what we picture.
Exactly.
Did anything get you thinking about frogs in particular?
I like them, and I sometimes live in the country, and they're constant, you know, when the rain is coming, and in the evenings, the big bullfrogs, and when I go swimming, you know, they all hop out of the pond, and sometimes when the very brave ones will get back in, and I imagine them swimming beneath me, looking up at me, and thinking of me as a really big frog. But it's just my sense that if you harm the planet anywhere, you're likely to be harming all of these creatures that normally people don't even consider. They don't think about bombing, you know, donkeys and camels and goats and chickens and sheep. And all of these beings are destroyed and maimed and wounded and harmed. And I would like children to think about them so that they, when they grow up, when they go to these places, they have it in their consciousness.
We're, of course, at a bit of a disadvantage in that we're, of course, speaking over the radio, so people are not able to see Stefano Vitale's breathtakingly beautiful pictures, images. Mm-hmm. This first page, this first spread is of a very idyllic scene. It appears in the Far East someplace with the words that I just spoke. Then we turn to the next page, and that same sort of idyllic scene is very brutally invaded by a huge metallic dark wheel. It looks like the wheel of a truck kind of coming straight through. And you write, picture frogs beside a pond holding their annual pre-rainy season convention. They do not see war, huge tires of a camouflaged vehicle about to squash them flat. I mean, that's a very brutal picture. And what you're, of course, trying to suggest is that this is just one other cost of war that we often do not consider.
Well, we don't, and that's to our, you know, unfortunate situation, because the more compassion that we can generate for what is happening to other people, the more compassion we can have for ourselves. And it's that compassion that then transforms us and changes us into people who can extend peace to the world, because peace is what we have internally. What we are extending to the world now is war, because the people who are making the war obviously are at war in themselves.
Hmm. A couple points are made along the way. I mean, along with thinking about frogs and donkeys and so on as other victims of war. One thing you say in another point in the book is, though war has a mind of its own, war never knows who it is going to hit. I guess that is another way to be thinking about something that's known as collateral damage.
Exactly, exactly. And collateral damage is, you know, beyond the people that we think of as being, you know, expendable. It goes into, you know, rivers and streams and trees and food, you know, food sources and gardens. Those are all those places that war never knows who it's going to hit. It can destroy anything. I mean, it is aimless.
You came up with another very intriguing way of talking about this when you wrote, war has bad manners. War eats everything in its path, and what it doesn't eat, it dribbles on. I mean, that's so fascinating. What an interesting image of warfare. Do you remember how that came to you?
Well, it's just looking at it and understanding that the toxins produced by war eventually, like saliva, like dribble, will go under the ground and into the water system. And then people will have to deal with that, drink the water, and become diseased and possibly die from it.
Hmm.
And there is no new water, so that water is the same water that eventually is rained on us, rained on other people around the world.
Hmm. One thing that intrigues me also about the book is that I think a lot of people writing a book like this would really want to end it with a very transcendent, radiant image of hope. And the last spread would be people joining hands on a rainbow in the sky. And you choose not to do that. I mean, you end the book beautifully, but not quite as positively as some authors might do that. I mean, you are willing to leave us with kind of an unsettling message at the end, and I'm sure that is no accident.
No, I'm leaving us with the consequences of our behavior, and that is a lesson in itself, that if you know, no matter how nice and how good you are or you feel you are, it's possible that you may find yourself in war, and you may find yourself inflicting things upon people or having things inflicted upon you that are really quite horrible, and that the end result of all of it is that you inhabit a polluted place that, you know, whose water you dare not even drink.
Hmm.
That is the only water there.
Your final words of the book are, now suppose you become war. It happens to some of the nicest people on earth. And one day you have to drink the water in this place.
Exactly.
That's where you leave it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about the fact that the title of your book makes a very strong statement, why war is never a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Some might see those words and take it to where it seems to take us, that we never, ever, ever should have war. Is that what you believe? I mean, do you honestly believe that war absolutely never should occur, or is it simply that if a war becomes terribly necessary for some reason, that we think about some of these consequences, which we can be very cavalier about? I mean, which of those is it?
I believe in self-defense, absolutely, and I believe in, you know, caring for people, and sometimes that leads to conflict. So I'm not saying that it's not sometimes necessary, but it actually, even in those cases, is not really a good idea. It's just an idea that might have to be implemented.
Hmm.
And the reason it's not a good idea is because it attacks our home here, which is Earth. Every war is a war against the planet. And so this is the only place we have to live. So I think future thinking, if we have a future, will actually understand that very clearly, and it will just become taboo. You won't go there.
Hmm. We have just a few moments left, I'm afraid, but I feel like I need to give you one more opportunity to just say a word about your brilliantly talented illustrator, Stefano Vitale, and maybe just a brief word about your collaboration.
Well, this is an amazing painter. He's an Italian who lives in Venice, Italy. We were brought together by my editor at HarperCollins, and I'm just as delighted as can be with his work. It's just glowing and beautiful. And it helps support the words of this poem and the message to children, because they can see how radiantly beautiful this earth is and the beautiful things that people make, you know, their houses and, you know, their boats and all of the things that people do so well. And so they can be really moved by the beauty as they ponder the destructiveness of war.
The book, again, Why War is Never a Good Idea, published by HarperCollins. And Alice Walker, I thank you so much for the honor of speaking with you, and I thank you for writing this beautiful book. Best wishes to you.
Bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be speaking with the athletic director at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and with one of his graduate assistants. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program. and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.